This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Welcome to Reinterpreting 1913. In this series, we look at the influence that the 1913 lockout had on a variety of artistic disciplines. In this episode, we look at two well-known authors whose work was influenced by the 1913 lockout, James Plunkett and Sean O'Casey. We talk to Joe Mooney of the East Wall History Group about how members of the East Wall community commemorated the lockout using the arts. But first we talk to Dr. Margarita Capuk of the Hugh Lane Gallery, and she tells us about two of the paintings featured in the Dublin Divided exhibition. We join Margarita as she tells us about Maurice McGonagall's painting, Dockers.
It shows these three monumental figures who completely dominate the canvas, with a ship in the background, and the ship is a very sort of red-orange, bright colour. These individuals they're not young men. Two of them appear to be, you know, well into their late 60s, maybe early 70s. And even looking at their hands, they're very sort of work-worn. This was actually painted in 1933-34, but there is a connection with the lockout. And in fact, there are very few images of the urban worker, and particularly there aren't any from 1913 that I'm aware of. But this one has a connection because James Larkin actually knew these men, and he sent them to McGonagall's studio to model for the painting. Another work that I do like is John Butler Yeats' The Bird Market. And it's an earlier work, but again, the focus is on the people who are carrying out the work, and in this case, children. That you have a little boy who is, his eyes are looking upwards, so he's obviously in conversation with an adult, and he holds in his hand a bird cage, and he's obviously trying to sell the bird. And in the background is another barefoot girl with a bird cage as well, and again, she's glancing up as if she's in conversation with an adult. And then you've two other children looking on anxiously to see how he's getting on in the bargaining process. What I like about this work is that he doesn't idealise or romanticise the individuals. You know, he interprets them sympathetically, but not with they're not coated in sentimentality. And of course, as I said, the plight of children during the lockout, and even the hardships that the children from the working classes went through before the lockout, is very, very evident.
Margarita told us about some of the artists directly involved with the lockout.
Well, I suppose a case in point would be George Russell, who was really a very talented individual. He was a journalist, theosophist, a writer, and of course an artist as well. Hugh Lane was one of his main collectors, so he's quite well represented in the collection. Now, George Russell was, in terms of the worker, he was editor of the Irish Homestead, which was an important, influential journal, and he was editor there for many years. He had been interested in I suppose, labour relations from many years previously, and he also was involved in the cooperative movement. So it wasn't specifically the urban worker that he was concerned with, it was the worker in general. And Russell was very instrumental in terms of writing and accusing the Dublin employers of really turning their backs on the workers, and that the repercussions of this would be felt for generations, which of course they have. And at the same time, Russell, in terms of his own artistic career, he produces many images of workers. So the images that are in the paintings that are in this exhibition show the log carriers, the stone carriers. You've also various other individuals. I mean, for example, William Orpen worked in the soup kitchens in Liberty Hall. He tells an interesting story of his involvement in the soup kitchens and how wretched the people were and how quiet they were coming in to receive some sustenance. And also another individual is Francis Sheehy Skeffington, who was executed in 1916.
Corey Yates commented on the involvement of the general arts community in the lockout.
Generally speaking, the artistic community were not engaged with or that sympathetic towards the lockout. The only person I know of who actually drew a picture, and it wasn't even a painting, who drew a picture of the lockout or scenes from the lockout, was William Orpen, who was known best as a portrait painter. But he did a picture of Larkin in the soup kitchen here. He put himself into a sketch as well of a soup kitchen, ladling out food. But he's the only one I know of. Very few people, you have to go back to Walter Osborne in the 1890s to get views of street life in Dublin, or living conditions in Dublin. A.E., who edited the Irish Homestead and was an artist as well, he did pictures, he did paintings in 1913 of people at work, but they were in the country. They weren't in the city. So even A.E. wrote, again, a magnificent letter to the Masters of Dublin, which was published in the Irish Times, and again has survived since, a magnificent piece of literature. But again, he didn't actually, as an artist, he never painted or drew in that period anything to do with the lockout. So there was that disconnect. And while there were people like Yeats and Synge around who wanted to change society, and people like Lady Gregory, again, a significant artist, a playwright in her own right, who were writing stuff, the fact remains that they were not engaging by and large with the labour movement. Say the only other person, of course, was Sean O'Casey, but you've got to remember at that time Sean O'Casey was still breaking into the arts. He wasn't a significant figure, wouldn't become one for nearly another decade. At that time he was a member of the Transport Union, supporter of Larkin, was a follower of Larkin all his life, but at that time he was just another face in the crowd.
Sean O'Casey lived through the lockout and lived in East Wall at the time. Joe Mooney of the East Wall History Group paints a picture of the man and how his surroundings filtered into his work.
Sean O'Casey would have lived here through very important years of his life. He would have lived here as a young man. He went to school in Barnabas School, which is just between East Wall and North Wall. He worked on the railway. He would have been working on the railway, I think, during the 1911 strike. He got involved with political groups locally, and he, of course, was the first secretary of the Irish Citizen Army. So he would have been very close to what was going on politically and socially at the time. He would have seen the poverty in the area. He would have seen how people were treated as workers. He would have seen how they tried to fight back. And you would have seen, in many cases, as it came clear in his plays, you would have seen how, in particular, the women in the families had to work really hard while the men might have been out fighting, struggling. He would have seen how the women had to struggle. But the best example for me in judging how influenced O'Casey was by the area was a woman telling me that when she was in school, they were doing an O'Casey play. And when the teacher was reading it, she said to the teacher, "Miss, that just sounds like my granny." And the teacher says, "Well, where do you live?" And she says, "Well, I'm from East Wall." And she says, "Exactly, so was O'Casey." So this girl in school could hear her granny's voice in the reading of O'Casey's work. So that for me means that the voices of the people were the authentic voices of East Wall.
We feature now an extract from O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars, performed by the Near Drama Company.
Two halves. A meeting like this always makes me feel as if I could drink Lockerdon dry.
You couldn't feel any way else at a time like this, when the spirit of a man is pulsing to be out fighting for the truth, with his feet trembling on the way, maybe to the gallows, and his ears tingling with the faint, faraway sound of bursting rifle shots that'll maybe whip the last little shock of life out of him that's left lingering in his body.
I felt a burning lump in me throat when I heard the band playing the soldier song. Remember last hearing it marching in military formation with the people staring on both sides of us, carrying with us the pride and resolution of Dublin to the grave of Wolfe Tone.
Oh, get the Dublin men going and they'll go on full force for anything that's trying to bar them away from what they're wanting. Where the slim thinking country boy would limp away from the first faintest touch of compromisation.
Two more, Tom. The memory of all the things that was done and all the things that was suffered by the people was booming in me brain. Every nerve in me body was quivering to do something desperate.
Jammed as I was in the crowd, I listened to the speeches pattering on the people's heads like rain falling on the corn. Every derogatory thought went out of me mind, and I said to myself, "You can die now, Fluther, for you've seen the shadowed dreams of the past leaping to life of the bodies of living men that show if we were without a tither of courage for centuries, we're vice versa now. Look a here." The blood was boiling in me veins.
I was born to draw me sword and wave it over me.
Will you stop your blathering a minute, man? Let us hear what he's saying.
"Comrade soldiers of the Irish Volunteers and of the Citizen Army, we rejoice in this terrible war. The old heart of the earth needed to be warmed with the red wine of the battlefields. Such august homage was never offered to God as this, the homage of millions of lives given gladly for love of country. And we must be ready to pour out the same red wine in the same glorious sacrifice. For without shedding of blood, there is no redemption.
Come on, man. This is too good to be missed.
Dr. Paul Delaney tells us about O'Casey's connection to the lockout and admiration for Larkin.
It's with his fourth play, the very controversial play, The Silver Tassie, which saw him break from the Abbey Theatre. He goes back to a period just before the outbreak of the First World War and then the First World War. And we see in The Silver Tassie him engaging with that community of people who would have lived through the lockout. This, of course, is the very community who also inhabit the plays Juno and The Plough and the Stars, and indeed The Shadow of a Gunman. That these people, the people that O'Casey is desperately keen to write about, are the people of the Dublin tenements, the people he knows to some degree. He knows better than pretty much any writer who precedes him, certainly. And there is the sense that for O'Casey is the target of his work. He describes on a number of occasions in the story of the Irish Citizen Army, he describes Larkin as an extraordinarily attractive figure. And there's a sense that O'Casey, like Plunkett, was very, very, very committed to Larkin and believed in Larkin to a great degree. And this is something for O'Casey which continues throughout his life, that he remains very attached to Jim Larkin for the remainder of his long life. He's someone that he talked about on numerous occasions in interviews with great fondness. And there's a sense that when O'Casey falls out with almost everyone else, which he does over and again, Larkin is often seems to be the exception in many respects.
In Dublin City in 1913, the boss was rich and the workers slaves, with women working and children starving. Along came Larkin like a mighty wave. The workman cringed when the boss man thundered. 70 hours was his weekly chore. He'd asked for little and less was granted. He's getting little, then he'd ask for more.
Another well-known author whose works were clearly influenced by the lockout is James Plunkett. His most well-known work, Strumpet City, was released in 1969 and chosen as Dublin's One City, One Book for 2013. Dr. Paul Delaney tells us why Strumpet City is so well remembered in the literary world.
Well, the funny thing is that Plunkett didn't witness the lockout himself. He was born much later. But there's a very strong sense that Plunkett was in contact with the generation of people who did witness the lockout, who did live through it, who survived it, and who did participate in it, both his own father, but also through the generation just before him. And also as a young man, when he was working in Dublin, he met through the unions Jim Larkin, when Larkin was at quite an advanced age. And there's a very strong sense that there's a sense almost of continuity for Plunkett. There's a sense that Plunkett, as the next generation of young Dubliners, is learning from the generation which preceded him, who were there during the lockout. And that's part of the importance, I think, of this text, that there's a sense of it as a link, a living link with the previous generation. And Plunkett is really trying to give us an overview of Dublin and of the city in the period between 1907 and 1914, the years preceding the lockout, and then the months of the lockout itself and just after. And he's trying to give us as varied kind of a description, a kind of almost a panoptical description of the city and of its inhabitants at this time. And that's quite unique. When Plunkett did it, extraordinarily ambitious attempt by him. But when he did it, he was really the first writer to do this, to try to write about so many different classes, so many different experiences, and to write about it in a fictional mode. It was quite new.
I asked Paul about the use of language and representation of characters in the book.
It's important if we think about it in relation to the genesis, actually, of Strumpet City, that the first text, I suppose, that Plunkett writes, which in many respects engages with this, is the one-act drama Big Jim, which was performed for the radio. And the very title of that play, Big Jim, tells us that it's really focused around the figure of James Larkin. And it kind of engages in part with the kind of the cult of personality of Larkin that Plunkett himself believed in. He was a tremendous admirer of Larkin. As Plunkett played with that text subsequently, and I suppose expanded it subsequently, initially for the play for the Abbey Theatre, The Risen People, which was first performed in 1958. And through that then for the novel Strumpet City, which is published in 1969, what you get even in the titles is a distancing from Larkin. So it goes from being something about Big Jim to being about the people, the risen people in the tenements in the play. And then from that, it actually becomes more about the city and about Strumpet City and about Dublin. And as a result, one of the things Plunkett tries to do in Strumpet City is really to give us this broad sense of Dublin and what Dublin looks like in the late Edwardian period and in the years leading up to the lockout. So we have this sense of a city which is very divided, a very class-ridden society, a colonial city, a city of great impoverishment, but also a city in which there are people with serious wealth. And a city where very different people are living very, very, very different types of lives. I suppose one of the ways in which Plunkett illustrates this simply is through the characters we get in the story, partly through the kind of lives they lead, whether they lead lives of kind of material well-being or whether they lead for deeply impoverished lives, the likes of Rashers, I suppose, most famously. But it's also there through the language that the characters use, so that characters like the Bradshaws, characters like Yearling, talk very, 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 very differently to a character like Rashers Tierney. And that Rashers describes things in this tremendous kind of colloquial slang, precisely. And that he describes things as if he is, in a sense, the man of the street. And Plunkett is keen to describe him in that way. And at times, Plunkett is keen to almost describe him, in a sense, as the embodiment or the epitome of the soul of Dublin. Bradshaw and Yearling, by contrast, talk in a much more refined mode. They talk much more in the style which you would expect of the upper middle class and the leisured or kind of gendered class, I suppose. And Plunkett is keen to try to describe that and to use different types of idiom in part to kind of illustrate the characters he's presenting. But he does that as well through his description of different priests in the text. So different priests we get also talk in very different types of idiom. So Father O'Connor, I suppose, most significantly, as one of the most complex characters in the text, talks in a way which is very, very, you know, it's full, I suppose, of the idiom of the church. He's described very much as almost at times a puritanical figure. And the way in which he talks is kind of reflective of that. It's deeply kind of permeated with religious diction. In addition to that, though, Plunkett is just absolutely desperately keen to stress the humanity of these people, that they aren't simply caricatures and that they aren't second-class citizens. And I think that's one of the great achievements of Strumpet City, that it is in part, now for us, it's a novel, but it's also, in a sense, an historical record. It's almost a monument, I suppose, of an age. It's a monument of a time in the mid 50s and 60s when it was written. And it's a monument of that period in Irish history and of a modernising Ireland. But it also then, in turn, also is a chronicle, really, of Ireland in the early 20th century, and one which really stresses the fundamental dignity and humanity of the people who were locked up in this bitter period.
We feature now an extract from Strumpet City.
Rashers was hungry. The warm odour of the bakery set up an aching in his mouth and his belly. Mrs. Bartley, if he asked her, would give him a cup of tea and a slice of bread when he got home, but his hunger was for more than that. He watched the pigeons still at work on the sack and thought of crisp, freshly baked loaves. It seemed a long way back to Chandler's Court. All day he had worked moving rubble from the garden of a woman in Sandymount, in the hope that she would offer him an evening meal as part of his payment. But when he finished, she had left to attend benediction for the feast, leaving word that he should call back for his money tomorrow. Now the dog would be waiting for him, and he would have nothing to give it. It was well for the pigeons flying high above the streets, mating, resting, pilfering grain. Tonight Rusty could be let out to root in the bins, with the chance of picking up God knows what class of poison. He himself could impose on Mrs. Bartley, a thing that troubled him, for she had not much more than himself. He stared at his own reflection, trying to think of an alternative. The pigeon at the sack had been joined by three others. They knew what was afoot, and stood waiting for the hole to grow and the grain to spill. They were patient. It was part of their way of existence and had happened many times before.
While Sean O'Casey's works are known worldwide, much of James Plunkett's work is only known in Ireland. I asked Michael Sharp, producer of Near FM's book show, why he thought that might be.
Well, of course, O'Casey wrote a lot more. He wrote plays. I mean, Plunkett did write plays, but they were performed on television, performed in Ireland. I don't know that he became internationally accepted, although he was very well in his lifetime. I mean, he was a member of Ace Donna, the artist organization. So he is read. And of course, Strumpet City has itself, particularly through the television production, has become, you know,
very well known. Yeah.
Very well known, and what RTE might describe as a nice little earner, I suppose. But, I mean, O'Casey was a full-time writer. Plunkett was not a full-time writer. I mean, he worked as a branch secretary of a trade union, and then he worked in RTE. So, I mean, they were different in that regard. And O'Casey's plays have been performed, you know, around the world and are still performed to this day, whereas Plunkett's reputation largely internationally would depend on the one book. They both exemplify one of the maxims that anybody who aspires to being a writer is told, you know, write about what you know.
Yeah.
And O'Casey certainly knew it. I mean, Plunkett was writing, I suppose, secondhand or historically, but O'Casey had lived through this. I mean, O'Casey was brought up in a tenement, and that's what O'Casey is writing about. And, you know, tenement life and the life of the working poor. So that they both had talents, and they wrote about Dublin at the time. But O'Casey obviously had the advantage, I suppose, that he experienced it firsthand, and he's writing about the tenements. But, I mean, Plunkett writes about the same thing, and you're writing about people in, you know, what happens to people who are living in that world at that time.
As Michael suggests, the picture painted by Plunkett of poor living conditions, especially in tenement housing, was a large element of what the workers involved in the union were trying to improve. One of the pivotal moments of the lockout's history was the collapse of a tenement building on Church Street, where several people lost their lives. Cathal Brennan explains the incident, and how it was a clear indication of the quality of tenement housing in Dublin at the time.
One of the reasons why I think the ITGWU had such an impact on Larkin as well was because the 1913 lockout wasn't just a trade dispute. It was about the living and working conditions of people in Dublin, mainly housing conditions, that the conditions are just appalling. And when we look at rates of tuberculosis, infant mortality, they're really quite excessive compared to other cities in the United Kingdom, other cities in Europe. And a lot of this comes down to the fact that people are living in very densely populated tenements, and this had the knock-on effect for the health of people. And I think Church Street really brought home to people just poor living conditions. This could have been anybody's street that this happened on. Like, if we look at the Church Street collapse, it happened on the 2nd of September, at about 9:15. It was number 66 and 67 Church Street, and they were owned by a Mrs. Margaret Ryan. Now, 7 people were killed, and a further 8 people were seriously injured when number 66 collapsed. Now, because that collapsed first, it gave people in number 67 time to get out. There was mass on at the time, and there was also a children's party in the Father Matthew Hall. Now, if they had not been going on, a lot more people would have been killed. We could have been looking at dozens, perhaps more killed. It showed people how densely packed the tenements were. It also showed the poor quality of the housing for a lot of people in Dublin. Now, 2 months before the collapse, Mrs. Ryan had been served with a 7-day order to erect a beam across the ceiling of the front room at number 66 and to repair the pier between the two houses. The completed work had then been passed by a dangerous building inspector, Michael Derham. So that raises the question, how much were the building standards enforced? How much did the corporation really care about the housing of people in Dublin? You have publications such as the Irish Worker, which were constantly drawing attention to poor living conditions, the role of landlords, slum landlords in Dublin, and the fact that so many councillors on Dublin Corporation were slum landlords themselves. The corporation would talk about the fact that they just didn't have the funds to house these people, and groups such as the Ivy Trust and the Dublin Arts and Dwelling Association, they provided houses and apartments in Dublin, but most rents, although not excessive, would have been out of reach of most working poor people in Dublin.
Given that Plunkett wrote Strumpet City 50 years or so after the lockout, I asked Michael, did he feel that if the book was written in 2013, would Plunkett have had more freedom in what he wrote?
I don't know. I mean, I think it might be received differently. But he does describe in the book, you know, the priest going into the bar and asking for a drink and the sort of shock horror among the other customers and even on the barman who's serving him. But, I mean, it happened and he was able to write about it then. He was writing at the end of the 1960s. Whether O'Casey would have been able to write in 1913 about priests going into bars, I don't know. But by the 1960s, Plunkett was able to write about it. It's more, I think, always about the way audience will receive something rather than what the writer is able to do. Although undoubtedly, I mean, there are things that are written now that couldn't have been written 50 years ago. Well, not so much couldn't have been written, but couldn't have been published or wouldn't have been published because they just wouldn't have been acceptable, but they wouldn't have got a readership. But again, that's about, you know, the way things are perceived.
The Abbey Theatre staged an adaptation of Plunkett's The Risen People in December 2013. I talked to some people at the event and asked them their opinions on Plunkett's works.
Ah, yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, very good.
Have you seen the play before? Or
no, I've never seen it before, no.
Would you have seen Strumpet City or any of the other sort of like...
Yeah. I'm well into it. My great-grandfather is Big Jim Larkin, you know. Okay. So we have a lot of history on us, you know.
Okay.
But it's very good, very interesting.
In terms of Plunkett, do you think it's a good representation of the time, you know?
I think so. You know, well, you do see kind of one side of the story as well, but it's very good. It's very good.
So are you enjoying the production tonight?
Oh, I am. It's very enjoyable.
And would you be a fan of Plunkett's work in general?
Not really, no. It's the first I've really, you know, come to see his work.
Yeah. And what's your impression then?
Excellent. It's very enjoyable.
Would you be intrigued to see, would you have seen Strumpet City or any of those in the past?
I saw Strumpet City, yeah. Yeah. It's a great portrayal of it, you know. It's a very difficult thing to do, to try and put like nearly a musical into it. But it's quite successful, yeah, it works.
To me, it seemed to, you know, it was a great historical window into what Dublin was like. And, you know, when you look back on that and you think of your problems now, you kind of go, you know, it gives a good perspective of them, yeah.
East Wall is a close-knit community with a great sense of community spirit. I asked Joe Mooney how some of the groups in the area commemorated the lockout through the arts.
In East Wall, the Peg Drama and Variety Group were involved in a production of The Risen People, and it was absolutely spectacular. A lot of the people in the play had come from this community. Some of them would have had family histories. We had people whose very life, their history, their community was invested in it, and that really came across in the play, the passion of that play. Just the raw emotion from the actors was just incredible. And I think that was a wonderful achievement for the community.
A group from the area also took part in the 1913 Tapestry Project. Joe told us about the panel they created.
We were told it was the Citizen Army panel, but what it actually is the Fintan Lawler Pipe Band, which was the band of the Citizen Army, and the Croydon Park panel. They walked here in the centre upstairs, and you could come into the centre any time and you'd see the women running up and down the stairs and huddled in a group around it. They've done great work, and if you look at the panel, it's the one with the red bandsmen in it. For the women, again, being the area that it is, some of them had history of their own families being involved in the lockout, being involved in the unions afterwards, and one of the women, by a nice coincidence, had family members who had been involved in the Fintan Lawler band. So there's a real crossover between the art, the culture, and the actual history of the lockout in this area. You look at it and you can see the tapestry and you might say, yeah, that's really good. But just think about it, the amount of work that went in, it was just absolutely an incredible achievement. And the women are very proud, and certainly I think the community should be fairly proud that they contributed to what's going to be a lasting piece of art and history.
That's all for this programme. I'd like to thank everybody who took part in the broadcast, Near FM and the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, for their continued support.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.